Test. This is David Crippen, and of the Edison Institute's Edsel B. Ford Design History Center in Dearborn, Michigan. And this is August 7th, 1986. And today we're in beautiful San Mateo. That's capital S-A-N, capital M-A-T-E-O, California, talking with Mr. Herman C. Brunn, B-R-U-N-N. Mr. Brunn is a well-known designer in his own right for many years, with his working with his father, with Brunn and Company, of the famous custom body shop in Buffalo, New York, and for many years with the Ford Motor Company, retiring, I believe you said, Mr. Brunn, in 1970, yes. We'll ask Mr. Brunn to talk about his father in some detail, talk about the Brunn Company in some detail, long ensconced in Buffalo, New York, as a major custom body house whose clientele not only included Ford and Lincoln, but included many other makes as well. Most notably, I think, at least initially, Pierce Arrow, who was stationed nearby nearby at the time. Then we'll ask Mr. Brunn to give us an extensive review of his own career as it impacted on the custom body history and Ford Motor Company. So let me now introduce Mr. Herman C. Brunn.
Well, Brunn and Company, Incorporated of Buffalo, New York, was founded by my father, Herman A. Brunn, in 1908. At the age of 16, he was apprenticed to his uncle, Henry Brunn, who ran Brunn's Carriage Manufacturing Company in Buffalo. And it was Brunn's Carriage Manufacturing. It was considered the top carriage builder in Western New York. And at the urging and forcing of his father and his uncle, why, he went to work at the age of 16 as an apprentice carriage maker.
What year was this, Mr. Brunn?
1900. What year was that?
I take it was pre-automobile time.
1898.
Just getting into the automobile era. Had Brunn and Company carriage, had Brunn and Company carriage makers gotten into the automobile business?
No, they had not. And Uncle Henry was deaf against them.
Why was that?
Well,
did your father ever say?
I'm talking to this one.
Please.
But anyway, I like to go along like this. He went in there and learned his business from the ground. Learned the body making. Learned the carriage body making, body building trade from the ground up. First as an apprentice, which one of his lowly jobs was to rush the growler. From the saloon across the street to the woodworkers just before lunchtime. Every woodworker had a pail with a handle on it, and he'd come along and put a stick through the hand through the handles and go across to the saloon across the street and fill them up with foaming brew and bring them back. That was his first job. But he went out and he learned to become an experienced woodworker. An excellent woodworker, and one of the things that he was most proud of, he built a carriage, a landau, for Harry Hamlin. All this was when he was working for his uncle, a rich man in Buffalo and a prominent customer of Brunn's Carriage Company, built a landau, and in 1901, the city of Buffalo staged the Pan American Exposition. This there were exhibits from most all of the nations in North and South America. President McKinley came to see the exposition, and he stayed in Mr. Hamlin's house, and this carriage, which my father had made, was used to transport the chief executive wherever he was going or needed to go. And my father, being a photography fan, got his view camera and his tripod and the security clearance to set up his camera on the top of a ladder directly across the street from where the president and Mrs. McKinley would emerge to go to the exhibition grounds. Well, it was all focused and everything up on the ladder when a whole line of cavalry moved up in front of him, and he looked down in the finder and they were coming out, so he jumped off the finder and ran between the horses, and he looked down just as the president was taking off his hat. And I'll show you the picture, it's in there. There. And the interesting part was that 2 weeks later, when they got out there to the exhibition grounds, the president had a handshaking ceremony, and he was assassinated. And 2 weeks later, he died. So this was one of the last, if not the last, picture taken of the president.
Incredible.
And it became very valuable.
Yes.
He made prints in his bedroom closet, contact prints, and sold them. I think he sold 1,500 of them to the Buffalo Express, which was the morning paper and the evening news and places like that. Well, this was the kind of stuff he was learning to make and had made.
You might describe this briefly for the in audio terms. This is a full-on shot of President McKinley just getting into a Brun Landau out in front of Mr. Hamlin's house, I take it. And on his way to the Pan American Exposition on September 6, 1901, and he has just taken off his hat and looks as if he's sort of saying hello to your father. Did he know that the Brun Landau was the...
No, there was applause and people all around, I guess, you know.
But I mean, this picture says you don't see it.
That Mrs. McKinley didn't want to be seen. If you can look closely there, you can see a black parasol going up in front of the
parasol. You see, she was just about to put the parasol, or she's putting it up right now.
If she hadn't had it up, he'd have had both.
Oh, my.
Well, anyway, that was the kind of work he did, but he was hell-bent to get into the drafting room where they did the layout. And
woodworking was fine, but he really wanted to get into the design area.
Yeah. And then with the approval of his uncle, why he went to the carriage builders drafting school. It's now, you probably know it as the Andrew F. Johnson School.
How do you spell that last word?
Andrew F. Johnson.
Andrew F. Johnson.
Did you heard of him?
No, I'm not.
Well.
Is it J-O-H-N-S-E-N or O-N?
O-N. Well, and.
Is that in Buffalo?
No, this was, I'm coming to that, this was on the Bowery in New York.
Oh, my.
Now, he went to school there 2 years and graduated, or whatever they called it, and evidently the denizens of the Bowery didn't fit in with Mr. Johnson's plans, and so he moved elsewhere, but this was after my father had gotten out of there. And after that, he established a correspondence course in carriage and automobile body drafting from his home in Gray, Maine.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Johnson's home in Gray, Maine. And practically every body design, every surface layout man, we should call him, in the Detroit automobile industry who went to that school at one time or another. Ray Diedrich was one of them. Of course, he was came afterward, after my father. He was younger than my father. And two of the Fisher boys.
And which ones?
And, well, Henry Greeby. I don't know whether you remember him.
Oh, yes. GM in Ford.
Mm-hmm. He came over to Ford.
G-R-E-B-E, right.
Yeah, G-R-E-B-E. And almost everybody of any account had gone to that school. See, that was back when the automobile bodies were being designed by carriage designers and using their styling types on the automobile as they did on the carriage. Mm-hmm. In other words, you had a chassis and you built a body and you sat it on that and bolted it down. And that's the way the custom bodybuilding went right up until the end, even through the 30s. Well, after that, he went to work for the Andrew J. Joyce Carriage Company in Washington, where he became plant manager of the Joyce Carriage Company, but he was always trying to get into somebody's graft room.
What year was this roughly? Can you pinpoint it?
Well, it was after the assassination. What does this say, 1901?
1901, yeah.
Yeah, well, it was shortly after that.
Okay.
And
that's J.O.
One time, Mr. Joyce, Ed Joyce, introduced him to William Hooker Atwood, who was the main operator of the New Haven Carriage Company. Mm-hmm. And the Hiram Percy Maxim, the inventor, was working on an electric car for Colonel Pope, who was, at that time anyway, was the biggest bicycle maker in the country, but he was going into the electric car. But they had to have a body designer and a body builder to build the body for this job. Maxim had got the electric mechanism working and all this and that, but the New Haven Carriage Company designed and built the body, and this man, William Hooker Atwood, who was noted for his fine design carriages, he was considered the expert on both interior and exterior design of the carriages. Mm-hmm. He had a great effect on my father's life. After that, he went up to Watertown, New York, worked for a carriage company up there where he met my mother. And then he eventually went home to take charge of his uncle's shop.
That was Babcock, wasn't it?
Babcock, H.H. Babcock.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was all enthused about the coming of the automobile. Uncle Henry, we'll call him, didn't seem eye to eye with it. No. Mm-hmm. Uncle Henry, I'm sure, didn't know the meaning of atmospheric pollution or anything, but he just saw, and other carriage builders did too, saw this big cloud of the automobile coming over the horizon. Mm-hmm. See, but Uncle Henry said, that smelly, noisy, greasy old thing is never going to last. Well, they couldn't get along, and the interesting part of it was that my father's father and Uncle Henry had married two sisters. And this made the sheaves more binding, as I say, because my father finally quit and obtained the local financing from a man by the name, an insurance man by the name of Sandrock there. And
Sandrock?
Sandrock. Mm-hmm. William J. Sandrock, a rich insurance man. And how he got the money, how he happened to know Mr. Sandrock was his mother was a milliner, my grandmother.
Oh, really?
One of the prominent milliners in Buffalo, and Mrs. Sandrock was one of her customers, and that's the way they got together.
That means dressmaking, does it not?
Right.
Milliner is a dressmaker or a hat maker?
Oh, hat maker.
Hat maker, right.
Bonnets, excuse me, they call it.
Bonnets, yeah,
they call
right.
them bonnets. Because even my grandmother lived to be 96 years old, and she, even after I was born, one or two of her customers used to come to the house to get their bonnets made by my grandmother.
Really?
Because she had what they called Peggy's, which was a dummy. For various people had their Peggy's there and the size of their heads. So she'd be up there with pins in her mouth and so forth, pinning up these hats for one or two people, and they'd come and then they'd have tea or chocolate, something like that, and chew the rag. But
but a Peggy was a favorite customer's head.
Head size, yeah.
Head size, right, yeah.
Like my wife has a wig in here now that, that you sit it on.
Yeah.
It looks about
right. Yeah, right.
That's Barbara, the one down in San Diego.
Oh, yeah. Cute.
8 years. Quite a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the peculiar part of it was, and what the spring on the family tie was, that they formed Brun Ann Company. Now the other was Brun's Carriage Manufacturing Company, and Uncle Henry had never seen fit to incorporate.
Oh.
So they, the place they got a hold of was an empty factory right across the street from the carriage plant.
No.
This didn't help things.
Was this a little Machiavellian move on your father's part, or was it just that the
No,
space
it's just
available?
There. There was a place.
Yeah.
There wasn't any Machiavellian. And Uncle Henry's lawyers, after about 6 months of my father being in business, when they first started like that, the automobile was coming along, and he didn't monkey with any carriages, but the first business they had was repairing, bumping out fenders and things like that.
Right.
Until he said he found out that the repair jobs took up just as much room in the plant, but they didn't bring in the money as the new cars did.
Right, yeah.
Well, anyway, Uncle Henry sent his lawyer over there and said, you got to take that Brunnen Company sign down because it's causing confusion with our customers, because one or two or three of the customers were coming across the street, and eight of the employees came across the street
and worked
for my father.
Great. Uh-huh.
Well, Mr. Sandrock's lawyer proved that Uncle Henry's 19-year-old company was younger in the eyes of the state of New York than the 6 months-old company, the Brunnen Company, across the street, because the Brunnen Company was incorporated and Brun's Carriage wasn't.
I presume they'd just gotten around to incorporating Brun's Carriage Company. That's what he found out.
And so, one of the first bodies that he built was for Leslie Carter.
Who was Leslie Carter?
Leslie Carter was a great competitor, if you want to call it, of Sarah Bernhardt.
Oh, really? Mrs. Leslie Carter.
Flaming red hair, and
yeah.
Only she was American, and she liked yellow, and that was the first one. That some young fella asked me. You see that yellow and black car up there? A young fella in Gross Point, who used to live in Gross Point, has that down in Florida now. He asked me one time, what was the first job, first custom body Brun built? Well, I wrote a story about that on I guess it was the Antique Car Magazine or something.
Yeah. How long ago?
Well, that I can't remember, but...
Was it Mrs. Carter's?
Yeah, that was the one there.
Can you describe it visually?
Well, in her, look, a lot of people wondered. Look, I was born in 1908 too.
Oh, okay.
Now, a lot of people wonder, how do you know all these things, all these details? Well,
right.
I'll tell you, if you had sat across the dinner table from my father for 35 years and heard the stories told and retold and things like that, why, you'd have it all up in here, too.
Well, tell us about that propensity of your father's. Was he one who would bring the business details home then to the dinner table and regale you with you and your mother?
Yeah, and grandmother.
And grandmother. Would you have any siblings, any brothers and sisters?
No, I'm
your
only
child.
Yeah.
So you got the full story, presumably from your
father. Yes, I've got the full story, I guess. Well, then this was one of the cars that got him started, and he had...
Well, this is apparently a 1908 Thomas.
This is a Thomas, yeah.
Is it a flyer?
Well, is that what they call it,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, Thomas Flyer, yeah. And so this was the first, one of the first custom bodies that your father, that the Fledgley...
Yeah. See, he didn't go into business until 1908, so...
Right, yeah.
Then he built another one for Mrs. Carter a couple of years later, and she was a great actress, but she was no businessman and her business person. And the second one, I'm not sure whether he got paid for 100% or not, but it was bright yellow.
Mm-hmm. With cane work along in here, that was yellow, and the rest was
fashion
black.
Fashion day, yeah.
Or cane be became the fashion.
He said that she told him she wanted it yellow, yellow, yellow. Well, she evidently got it, and he followed her around the country on her tours with samples of yellow to see if she liked this and liked that, and would meet her in the dressing room and things like that. And finally, he got a telegram in the middle of the night one night at home and said, "Yellow, beautiful, go ahead." So this little aspect of the business is what made it very fascinating and interesting.
Well, just a footnote to that, apparently she one of her demands was it be kept very low.
Yes, that's right. And my father kept saying, "Well, if it's that low, you won't be go get in or get out." She said, "If it, I don't care how low it is, if it's good looking, I'll get in and out on my hands and knees." Because he reached, you know, every draftsman carried a folding, a 6-foot folding rule, you know.
Ah, yes.
He carried it in his hip pocket. She said, "Don't pull out your old ruler. I don't care what it is, what it measures. It doesn't look good."
Well, this was probably his first experience with a rather demanding, somewhat imperious.
Imperious is the word.
Famous actress, yeah, with flaming red hair, according to a description.
Mm-hmm. Ashley Stevens. He told a story about, he became quite a fan of hers. He was
the famous drama critic of Chicago. Yeah.
Ashton Stevens.
Ashton Stevens, yes.
drama critic. He said to her, I mean, he had a lot of nerve, I think, he said to her, "Ashton Stevens says that your hair is a credit to your apothecary." And she says, "Is that so?" He said, "Yes, it was in his column or something."
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. Well, he didn't say anything about the night when his wife died and he cried his heart out on my lap, did he? Well, I don't think we need to dwell too much whether that's going to be of interest to everybody or not.
Well, it's fascinating to know that that your father's his first major commission was a very famous one, and evidently got him started on the road to the custom coat.
Well, then there were. Rich people in Buffalo and rich people in Rochester,
sure.
And especially Rochester, that I don't know whether you want to go into the Selden story or not.
Please, yes, let's do it, yes, that's very important.
Okay. Shortly along, around the 1911-1912 period, he got the idea he could make a, today we'd call it a convertible.
Mm-hmm.
He called it a sheltered Phaeton.
A sheltered Phaeton.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. This was the first one.
Can you describe it in visual terms?
Well, it was...
I can see it, but our audience can't see it.
Yeah, it's the way it is with the top, was with the top down.
Was it a... anyone commission it as a...
First he built one for himself on the Rio.
Chassis.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Selden... Well, you know the Selden story, but after the second suit with Henry Ford, Mr. Selden's patent was...
Invalidated. Invalidated.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, for the second.
The second one,
yeah, right.
Was not...
First,
the second one was valid. First one was validated, and the second one was validated.
Right.
But Henry Ford proved that the Selden patent was a two-cycle engine, and what they were using, and the Ford and the other people that wouldn't pay that body we're using was a four-cycle engine.
Right.
Hence, the judge ruled there was no infringement.
This is on appeal.
Pardon?
On appeal.
On appeal, yeah.
Right, right. How does
you know, you know those details are more than I do, but that...
But how does the Brun convertible fit into that story?
Well, Sellin then, George Baldwin Sellin, who was a better lawyer, I guess, than he was an inventor, but he went into making the Sellin car down in Rochester. And my father just designed one and a drawing and took it down to Rochester and got an order for a sample, and then they eventually got an order for, I don't really know the quantity, but a large quantity, which you really shouldn't have handled, but
mm-hmm.
right in the middle, when there was a whole bunch of these things under construction, why Sellin had to go into the hands of receivers, and there they were stuck with all that money.
My gosh.
So this was quite a crisis, but he finally obtained additional financing from Mr. Wepner, William J. Wepner, I may be mentioned in there.
W-E-P-N-E-R?
W-P-P.
W-P-P.
W-E-P-P.
Yeah, right.
And Mr. Wepner became secretary and treasurer, which gave my father time to look after the designing and getting business. And he was a very shrewd businessman, and that's the way the thing went on, see?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Mr. Wepner, what was his background? Was he a local risk taker or financier?
No, he was actually, his family were meat packers in Buffalo.
Ah, I see.
But he and my father had gone to school together, and he had $5,000 he wanted to invest, and he invested in it.
Good.
Took out a lot more.
I bet. Sellin receivership left your father rather strapped for ready cash.
He had advanced
these bodies.
But they finally got on their feet again and went on, and they built bodies for prominent people like Glenn Curtis, and they did quite a business down in Pittsburgh on Packard and Pierce Arrows, mm-hmm. individual cars. And One was for Mary Roberts Reinhardt. I don't know whether you know her. She was a mystery story writer.
Well-known author, right.
Her husband was a doctor in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And then along in 1921 or 1922, they got a telephone call from Ralph Getzinger, who you probably know all about.
I wonder if we could move back just very briefly to Mr.
Getzinger was sales manager for the Leland's.
Could you spell his name?
G-E-T-S-I-N-G-E-R.
Fine.
And, he's been the back. He's been the source of a lot of information about Lincoln and Ford.
Hmm.
Called Brun on the phone and said that William R. Laidlaw, who made so much wool body cloth,
Laidlaw,
yeah, had recommended that Brun might be the guy that could get Lincoln out of their spot. You know, the Lincoln bodies weren't good. They weren't good looking and they weren't well built. They were designed, as I understand it, by a man by the name of Woodbridge, who was Mr. Leland's son-in-law, and he himself was a milliner.
Really?
When the first Lincolns came out there, people got out and walked home from demonstrations because of the body rumbles that were transmitted through the chassis and their body. And the reason for this was that they tried to make an all-steel roof.
Hmm.
And in order to eliminate that, you had to put a leather center in the top of the car.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it'd be steel around and above the drip molding, mm-hmm. but there was this leather center. This is what killed that rumble. Until General Motors came along, or Fisher Body came along with what they called a turret top, mm-hmm. which they accomplished by developing a sound deadener, which they mm-hmm. sprayed on the inside, of which everybody took up, of course.
Mm-hmm. But the leather top was the first baffle, a sound baffle.
Yeah.
That was
used. And,
excuse me, stop right there. Right at the end. Yes, we're ready to go. Yes.
Well, the result was that they got a good front-end company, got a good-sized contract. Mr. Edsel Ford had just, he was only 27 years old then, mm-hmm. as I remember it, and he had just taken over the management of the Lincoln operation from the Lelands.
This would have been in 1924 then.
Pardon?
Was this 1922, I think.
I mean, I can't swear yeah. by my days, but
The Lelands had just sold it to Henry Ford.
Yes.
And Edsel Ford had taken it over as the general manager of the position.
Yes. Well, in the meantime, my father had been made body designer and body engineer of the Lincoln Motor Company, and Mr. Ford said he wanted to carry that on, carry that contract on, and the result was that they built 12 different style bodies, sample bodies. These were then shipped to Detroit and built by production plants. One was known as the Anderson Body Company. Then I think it eventually became Murray. And
in
the
Detroit.
Other,
in Detroit.
Pardon?
In Detroit.
Yeah, in Detroit. And there was another production body company in Buffalo called the American Body Company that they built production bodies for Ford, and I believe Babcock even built some in Watertown. But anyway, after that, Mr. Ford decided that he wanted to have some body engineer right there on the spot, and this is when he hired Henry Corsilius from Brewster. Mr. Ford and Mr. Corsilius made a good team because they were both conservative men.
This was Henry Corsilius, mm-hmm. Corsilius.
Well, that's close. I just
need it for the transcript.
Pardon?
Before you get into Mr. Corsilius, I want to move you back a bit to something that's fascinating to me. The hiring of Mr. August Keller and the Goldie Top affair. Can you remember that?
Well, I know Gus Keller, but
the Goldie Top affair, which he bought the he had come to this country representing the Traugott Goldie Company to promote
yeah.
the one man top.
Yeah.
And that was the Goldie patent. And he apparently came to this country and began to manufacture a certain type of one man top for.
That's right.
Did that ever have any connection with the Brunnen Company?
Oh yes, as a matter of fact, we were I was about that high. The Brunnen Company was the sole distributors for the Goldie patent top in this country for,
mm-hmm.
for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I used to see Gus Keller when they, after I'd moved to Detroit, they changed the name, but it was basically the same top.
moved to Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Ypsilanti, that's right.
Motor State Products.
Motor State Products, that's
right. And kept the Goldie patent, or at least developed tops that were based on the original Goldie patent.
That's right.
G-O-L-D-E. Okay.
Now, this, of course, was prior to when we first started on the Goldie top. It was not a power top by any means.
No.
It was a one-man top. And the gag that went around, yes, it was one man and two women to put it down, see?
But it was quite a sensation, was it not, in the automobile business?
Yeah, darn right.
Yeah, okay. Well, your father has made an important connection with Ford Motor Company, specifically the Lincoln Car Division.
Yeah.
Lincoln Motor Car Division. And Mr. Edsel Ford is president of the Ford Motor Company, but more importantly, in this context, he is the general manager of the Lincoln Motor Car Division. His father has given him sort of carte blanche, has he not, to develop it as a luxury car line. Right. This is in the early 20s. So, Mr. Your father, Mr. Brunn, how did he meet Mr. Ford? How did he meet Henry and Edsel Ford? They seem to have been fairly good friends.
You said, excuse me, but I don't hear as well as I used to. What did you say?
How did they meet? How did Mr. Ford,
well,
how did the elder Mr. Ford?
Here's the way they met. Ralph Getzinger, the sales manager, called him up, and Ralph Getzinger hired him because the interesting part is that after I came to Detroit and was working on interior trim materials, I worked with the Getzinger Fox Company very closely with Mr. Getzinger Sr. and Ralph Jr. and Gordon Getzinger. They were the representatives of Chatham Manufacturing Company down in North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And so I worked with Mr. Getzinger Sr. and his sons and Tom Fox.
Mm-hmm.
They had, I don't know, I'm getting off the track.
No, you're okay, you're fine.
You get out of the Getzinger. See, Mr. Getzinger was Mr. Getzinger was sales manager, and faced with the problem of selling these cars, which he couldn't sell, and was while this car, Mr. Lino's, was the most perfectly made thing mechanically, from a style wise and comfort wise, it lacked a lot.
Yes,
you've probably heard that from other people.
No, but these people have not. So you go right ahead. What was the reason for that? He was a marvelous engineer, but there was nobody in the company had any styling sense, right?
That's it, exactly. See, these fellows back there in those days, like the Lelands and they were machine shop men, and
even Henry Ford.
Well, Leland, you know, he founded the Cadillac.
Right.
And there's one story about them was that they were over in England and they took five Cadillacs over there and they took the engines all apart, spread the parts out on the floor. Have you heard this?
No, I haven't heard this.
Spread the parts, mixed them all up, laid them on the floor in this concrete floor in this place out at Croydon Aerodrome. And it rained that night and the rain leaked through and the parts got all wet. And the next morning they came in there and put the engines all together and they all started at the first turnover except one because of the interchangeable parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Leland was a fantastic engineer.
Yes.
But unfortunately, no one.
And I remember years later when I was, the thing my father did that was so helpful to me was when I became old enough, he took me around with him, and I met these people, like Mr. Edsel Ford and so forth.
Yeah.
And we were at the auto show in Detroit. I wonder where the heck was it? It was downtown on 2nd Avenue, way downtown. Anyway, we ran into Wilford.
What building was it in?
I couldn't remember. Yeah.
Wilford was
Henry Sonny. He was also a brilliant man because he was the man that made the first V8 engine.
Devised
on Cadillac.
The pattern, yeah. Uh-huh.
That old Cadillac building on Clark Street is, what are they doing there?
Not sure.
There's a big bronze plaque there in honor of Wilford Leland and his designing and engineering of the four-cylinder opposed V8 engine.
Mm-hmm.
And signed by the old guard at Cadillac.
Oh.
I often wonder what became of that bronze plaque.
I'll take a look, see if it's still there.
There's other people that have said that too, and I haven't heard any answers.
I'll make a note to find out for you.
Yeah, it'd be interesting because...
Second Avenue and what?
No, on Clark Street.
Oh, Clark Street.
Yeah, you know, where the Cadillac plant was.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, there was one Cadillac fanatic around here who went to see Mrs. Wilford Leland, who was still alive, this is 4 or 5 years ago, and living down in a new developed area in Detroit. Well, the nearest thing I can tell you about was near Stroh's Brewery. What is that? Lafayette Plaisance?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they call that?
Yeah.
And he went down to see her to see where that was, and I can't remember whether they found it or not.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to try and find out.
But Mr. Wilford Leland said, you know, Mr. Brown, I think if we'd have had your designs and engineering at the start of this thing, we'd still own our car. But it was a nice statement, anyway.
Before you go further, can I move you back to Mr. Victor A. Lang?
Yes, Victor Lang was our factory superintendent and mm-hmm. one of the men that you can give credit for the quality that was built into Brown bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend down in Saratoga here. It's right outside of San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
Who has a 1938 Brown limousine that he's been, these guys that are destroying these things themselves make me laugh, because one guy had a Touring Cabriolet in Cleveland, Jesus, he died before he got that.
Really?
Finished.
Now this is Bill Schmidt in what city again?
Saratoga.
Right.
That's right, there.
He's been San Jose. Yeah, he's been trying to restore this now for how many years?
Well, he took me down there the first year I came here in 78 and showed it to me, and it hasn't gone much further since.
Does he want some help? Does he ask you for help?
Well, he's asked me for help.
Yeah.
I've helped him on running boards, see.
Yeah.
Running boards are getting almost impossible to get. They have to make them for the Lincoln.
These are these distinctive all-weather bromes that you made from about the mid-30s to the early 40s, and several of them later on for the Ford family, didn't you know?
No. No, no, this is much, much, much bigger. I'll show you those.
Okay, we'll get that later. Yeah, okay, I was just...
That was at the end, but...
Yeah. But I mean,
Bill came to me, and I had pictures of a close-up of a white running board, white rubber running board. We'll get to that later. And he said, where the hell can I get running boards? I'd have to have them made at $5,000 a pair. And I had a photograph of this white rubber running board, which is the same size and shape as this would fit on.
Yeah. How does this relate to Mr. Lang?
Well, Schmidt says, Herman, I don't understand how you fellows ever made any money after I see all the quality that's built into that car.
Ah, okay.
Well, Mr. Lang was one of the key men next to my father. He was the guy that built the quality into it, and he and my father agreed on things. And, well, like the folding canopies, you know, on a town cars,
mm-hmm.
where the arm swung back into a box up there,
uh-huh.
that was all Victor's doing. Mm.
So, in effect, for a number of years, your father created the designs, and then Victor Lang brought them to reality through engineering.
Victor Lang, during the war, he was, as many of these fellows were, several Europeans. He was a Czechoslovakian.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no, Hungarian.
Yeah.
But he was a German-Hungarian. He spoke German.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether you know or knew Martin Regitko that worked for Willoughby.
Longtime Ford employee while you were there.
Yes, he was, yeah.
Yes, right.
Well,
very well.
He came from the same place in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
Only Victor, I think Victor is what they later called a Sudeten German, if you know what I mean, when Hitler wanted to take that over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, he came to this. Victor,
that
was Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, because Sudeten German,
Victor could talk Hungarian and Czechish, and he could also talk German and English pretty good, quite well.
Yeah.
Quite well. Yeah. Only he pronounced his V's as Wobble.
Oh, yeah.
You ever heard those guys?
Yeah.
No, Wobble.
Sure.
He called himself Victor. But otherwise, he was great. And when I came up here in 1944, Martin, they pushed me into work for Martin Regitko here on the drafting table in the old engineering lab. He says, "Hermann, what is Victor doing?" Well, I said, Victor was working for, during the war, was working for Curtiss Airplane, and I don't know whether he's there or not. Well, could you find out if he'd want to come up? And I found out, and yeah, Victor came up and worked there until he retired.
You're talking about what?
Victor Lang.
What company?
For Ford.
Ford, yeah.
Ford.
You didn't say that. Well, go ahead.
This was called the.
Remember, you're
this was when
me.
Bob. Who was the chief designer over there? Gregory.
Bob Gregory, yes.
Was the head designer.
Remember, you're talking to the microphone, not to me. Yeah, that's okay.
I think it's going to be all scrambled up.
No, no, you're fine.
Somebody's
you're
got
fine.
Unscrambled.
That's fine. No, we don't bother scrambling. Chronology is not that important. I just want to get the salient.
Well, the chronology I always thought was very important, but it's
important. But I want to get the details that you might have normally skipped. Yeah, okay.
All right. Victor came up, and he and I roomed together in the place over on Pinehurst in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And the helpful thing about Victor was he had a car.
Mm.
He drove his car up. I didn't have any car, but 3 months before Victor came up, I had to walk from Pinehurst over 6 Mile Road to Livernois at 6 o'clock in the morning and eat my breakfast there and get on a Livernois bus and go, well, what would that be, south, wasn't it? Down toward the Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
Get off at some street down there and walk a block up to where one of the clay modelers lived and ride in with him.
Good. Who was that clay modeler? Do you remember his name?
Well, I probably will. I'll probably remember, but I can't think of him right now.
But back to 1922.
Yeah. Well, the Brown Company built a design. My father did the designing, and of course, Victor collaborated with him and put his pieces in there, and these were the 12 standard Lincoln bodies. As I said, some built by American Body Company in Buffalo, and some built by, I think it became eventually Murray.
Murray.
It was called Anderson at that time.
Can you tell us a bit about the details of this particular situation? Run Company is in Buffalo.
Yeah.
And they get the contract for the bodies that your father has dreamed up, the designs.
We
right?
built what we called in those samples. Today they know as prototypes.
Prototypes, right. And then
send them up to.
You ship them by rail up to.
Up to Warren Avenue, Livernois Avenue.
Right. And that would be what? The old Lincoln plant.
Yeah, the old Lincoln plant.
Right. You have to explain this to.
I know. I understand.
Then Mr. Edsel Ford would.
We'd go up there, and my father and Victor would go up there, and Mr. Ford would come down in that garage where I spent a lot of time after I got working there in that executive garage, and look the cars over.
Uh-huh. And what can you remember a specific instance to illustrate how Mr. Ford would choose and. What would be the relationship between your father and Mr. Ford?
It was very close.
Edsel Ford, yeah.
There's one thing I really have to go back. You like stories
about
this was before Ford had bought the place, and Mr. Getzinger had called, and my father and Victor went up there. Mm-hmm. And they had all their standard cars lined up in that executive garage on Warren Avenue. Mm-hmm. And they picked them up at the Michigan Central Depot, and they started out there in this garage at 10 o'clock in the morning.
These were not drivable prototypes, were they? I mean, were they?
No, I'm not talking about prototypes now. Right. I'm talking about the current first Lincoln production bodies, made by Brun.
Yeah, right.
Well, they started with three or four people taking notes and so forth, and my father and Vicar going down there and criticizing them. And they had reams of paper, so the story goes, before they had even covered two cars. About 4 o'clock, Mr. Henry Leland was all tired out, and he'd quit and gone home. And Wilford finally says, "Listen, Mr. Brun, can you design us a good-looking line of saleable automobiles?" And boy, my father was very enthusiastic. I think he said, "Just give us a chance, Mr. Leland." Mm-hmm. So they got a $50,000 contract to do this, which in that day seemed to be a lot of money, you know.
Right.
A lot of this stuff, when I wrote this article, I confirmed with Mr. Getzinger. I went over and saw him. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is he still alive?
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. He died before we left Detroit.
Okay.
101, I think. But that I thought was quite interesting. And another thing that showed what a fine man and a fine gentleman, there was no finer gentleman or no finer man or no more considerate man to do business than Mr. Edsel Ford. You've probably heard this before.
No.
Well, it certainly was with us, and he was very considerate, and I was with my father that time, and we were in Mr. Ford's office over there in the old building on Schaefer Road, and this was about 50 bodies for the custom line, town cars.
Yeah.
And we sat there, and my father had been fretting over this all night. They said, "Mr. Ford, you know, we appreciate this order and the confidence you've placed in us, but I almost lost my business once," referring to the Selden situation. Somewhat similar production where I took on more than I could handle, and I'd almost rather have half the number and be sure they were going to be taken. I hope you won't be offended at my making this statement, because most executives would say either take it or get the hell out, you know. I was sitting there watching. Mr. Ford said, "Well, Mr. Brun, I understand, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make this." See, my father said, "Look, you might be over in Europe or someplace and the bottom fall out of the market, and we'll get a telegram to stop working there, I'll be again." Mm-hmm. He said, "I tell you what I'll do. Make the contract non-cancelable, no deferred shipments, and I'll sign it myself." Now, how do you feel about that? "Well, Mr. Ford, that's wonderful. I just feel embarrassed." And he said, "Well, no, I understand. That's the way it'll be."
Mm-hmm. The business about the putting together the car at this point is of interest, I think. You would have a... explain to us again. Your father would design the body in Buffalo.
He would. He had a little niche in our home on Otis Place there, if you want to call it a studio, and with the right kind of a window, or right kind of a light, and until he got the organization going, and Victor Lang there, and Mr. Wepner there handling the other part of it, he spent many a Sunday and many a night in the back there making these drawings. All those Selden drawings were made in that back room. And my mother and I looking over his shoulder, and I was only about that high, see?
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, when he was able to put his full time on that, and of course, he did the work down there. But sometimes when he was hell-bent to get something done, like we had a summer home later out on Lake Erie, he'd bring it out there and work, sit out on the porch in the sunshine and work all day on things. See?
Mm-hmm. And so he was pretty much the idea man, the design man.
Yes.
And Mr. Lang would engineer the designs, and then you would have body builders such as the American Body and Anderson Murray in Buffalo, Detroit.
We didn't have them.
No, but I mean you would contract with them to complete the bodies.
As we designed them.
As you designed them. And then
my father went there. I can remember my father and Victor and Wetter going up to back and forth to Detroit about three times a month for 4 or 5 years.
To Anderson?
Yeah, and yeah. up to the plant on Warren Avenue to
mm-hmm. right, yeah.
See that it was all right and so forth. And then I drove a number of times with them over on Niagara Street to the American Body Company when they had problems on the jobs over there that weren't coming out like they were supposed to come out, you know.
That was in Buffalo, of course.
Yeah.
So that when American or Anderson finished the cars, they would be shipped then to Ford or to Lincoln or to whatever body company.
These were the production cars. Now then there was, after a while, Mr. Ford wanted to get Mr. Cresselius in there and as far as the engineering was concerned, but then he wanted to get some of the other prominent bodybuilders like Diedrich and Willie Barron and Willoughby and Judkins and so forth. So he established this whole custom line. And the nice thing about it was that there was no conflict of interest in there. I mean, like Run built the town cars, the all-weather Brougham and the all-weather Cabriolet and the convertible Victoria and later on, the Touring Cabriolet. Now, the convertible Victoria, we lost those to Diedrich back in 1928, and then Waterhouse had it in 31, but we got them back in 30, no, Waterhouse had them in 30, we got them back in 31 and continued on with the convertible Victoria up until the end in about 1940.
How about the dual cowl fan?
We built dual cowl fans prior to 1930.
Mm-hmm.
After 1930, they began building them in the Lincoln plant. I mean, as a production job.
As a production job, yeah. Was this a profitable as well as a relationship between your father and Edsel Ford?
Very much.
Very much so, because it really established Brunn as a although your reputation had preceded you and your father's reputation for good engineered designs had spilled over to other companies, the Ford contract really gave you a
well, there
boost.
Was one model there in 1920 to the 1927. Just a minute, it won't be in there, I don't think.
Tell us about that model and why you brought it up.
Yeah. All right, in the 1920s, we built 214 of town Broughams, all-weather town Broughams, as they were called. Seven passenger, forward-facing auxiliary seats of a model 166B. There were 214 of these built, and George Walker, who was the purchasing agent at that time, they're hollering for more and hollering for more all the time. And
George Walker, first aid for whom?
For Lincoln.
Lincoln, yeah. That wasn't the later George.
No. No connection.
No connection.
Uh, We were shipping about 19 a month on this, these cars.
Out of Buffalo? Or out of American Body?
No, out of Brun.
Brun, okay.
This was the Custom Series.
Custom Series, not the production.
No.
Okay.
In most cases, these bodies were shipped to Detroit, to Warren Avenue,
mm-hmm.
where they were mounted on a chassis up there.
The Lincoln plant, yes.
At the Lincoln plant. Now, in other cases, when there was something special about the car or it was going down east, they would send us the chassis and we'd do the mounting down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it would go to the branch, like in New York or in Washington or wherever it was going, where the dealer checked over the mechanical part of the car. We didn't want to be responsible for that, although we could and did put the cars together. And
when you say the dealer, was that the Lincoln dealer?
Well, yeah, or the branch.
Well, the Lincoln branch dealer.
It would go to the branch first, and then the dealer would pick it up from the branch. And,
right.
Well, like at 1710 Broadway in New York.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
214 of these made. This is the one we call our bread and butter car.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting part about this one here, this car happened to be bought and purchased by Tommy Hitchcock. Now, I don't know whether you ever know anything about Polo.
Tell us about Mr. Hitchcock.
Pardon?
Describe Mr. Hitchcock's background.
Tommy Hitchcock was the world's greatest polo player, had the world's highest handicap, and a very rich man.
Mm-hmm.
And he had one of these. And I was at the New York Salon at the Commodore Hotel one day. I was alone there late in the morning. Not many people around. When a fellow walked in and introduced himself as Mr. Hitchcock's chauffeur and said, "We have one of your cars." And
stop right
well, I said, "I know who Mr. Hitchcock is."
You gonna stop it?